on the 11th to last narrow line in Rashi, Amar Luhu Rava Livnei. The Gemara here provides one more, I'll call it ethical will, if you might want to use that term, that Rava, in this case, gave to his children.
Oh.
And he said the following, Kisha'atem Chotchem Bastar, when you cut meat, Al Tachtechu, Al Gav Hayad, don't put the piece of meat in your hand and cut. The Gemara now interpolates into the Braisa. It's an interruption, into Rava's statement. This is an interruption. Ika da amre mishum sakana, the ikra da amre mishum kilkol suda. Why should you not cut the meat while holding it in your hand? One reason is kusakana, because you might really cut yourself and injure yourself. And the other reason is, no, well, maybe we're not concerned about sakana, but we are concerned about you're nicking yourself and you're bleeding all over the food. So you'll be okay, but nobody's going to want to eat the food. So that was instruction number one. Okay, that's not a, I guess in light of the contemporary circumstances in which we find ourselves, it's worth noting that even though you might ask, what is this doing in the Gemara? This is not a halachic statement. And the answer is, it is a halachic statement. If you think about the nature of the Talmud Bavli, which includes a broad range of things, including medicines, cures, and so on, that we might regard them as not being correct or not being efficacious ever anymore, whatever it is. But the notion that that which contemporaneous medicine considers appropriate is in fact a halachic obligation is expressed by the fact that the Gemara all over Shas quotes all sorts of things that you can't do because it's dangerous, things that you should do to cure X, and so on and so forth. The fact that the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, granted he quotes it in Hilchos Deos, but the Rambam spends a couple of chapters talking about proper hygiene, proper diet, and so whether, and some of that actually, ironically, actually does hit home, not all of it. But the fact that the Rambam saw fit to put that in the Mishnah Torah tells you something, that it's not merely a strict halacha of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah, but how one lives a life properly, orderly, safely, and so on is also considered part of Torah. Today, we tend not to see that because we have great specializations. So rabbis handle shailas that appear in Shulchan Aruch, and doctors handle, questions of medicine. And I'm not arguing against that, but it does sort of blur the sense that when something is considered medically, scientifically appropriate from a health perspective, from a safety perspective, that is binding halachically. And even when it's not, doesn't rise to the level of specific danger, it's supposed to still guide the way a Torah Jew leads his or her life. All right, so that was the first one. The first thing he told them is don't cut the meat on your hand. That's pretty good advice. Use a cutting board. Secondly, and I would also tell you probably from a hygiene sanitary perspective, probably they weren't wearing gloves. So I don't think most of us would like to have a piece of meat that someone held in their hand and was cutting. I think we'd rather just put it on the plate and cut it that way. Number two, he said to them, V'al teshvu al mitas aramis. So he says, don't sit on a, aramis here probably means non-Jewish. It doesn't mean specifically Aramaic. It means a non-Jew's bed, a non-Jewish bed. I know that's not clear. What does that mean? The Gemara will, in a moment, quote three interpretations. And finally, V'al tavru achorei beis hakneses b'shar shatzibur mispalun. You shouldn't walk behind the shul. In other words, you shouldn't walk past the shul in the back at the time that tzibur is davening. So those are the three things he told his children. So what is the meaning of each one? So the first one, the Gemara explained already. It's a piece of good practical advice because you're going to cut yourself slightly or badly if you're cutting the meat on your hand. Okay. Now the Gemara says, Valteshva mitas aramis. What does that mean? So ika da amri, there are going to be three interpretations here, and you can probably figure out immediately which is the one that caused this statement to be quoted here. Ika da amri, lo tiganu below kriyashma. You should not go to sleep without reciting kriyashma. In other words, that would a non-Jew would go to sleep because a non-Jew doesn't have a mitzvah kriyashma and doesn't recite kriyashma. So you shouldn't go to sleep on a mitas aramis means go to sleep without reciting kriyashma. Number two, v'ika da amre, delo tinasfu giyarta. You shouldn't marry a convert. So I have to talk about this a little bit because on the surface it appears very troubling. You would think that a statement, the mere existence of such a statement in the Gemara constitutes onas ager, right? What happens if a ger reads the Gemara? What's the point? What was his advice to them in not marrying Gioris? And I will just tell you, by the way, from a pragmatic perspective and from a societal perspective, and from the perspective of incorporating gayrim to the community. So my wife has studied this issue. I don't know if she ever spoke in the context of KJ, and the rare occasion she might have spoken. But one of the things that's a big problem in the community is that people often set converts up with converts.
And that's let's leave it. Wait till it dries, because it's been in the garage for 15 years. I don't know if it's the exact same color.
Marshall, you're...
Wait, could you mute everyone, Rabbi?
It's usually not a problem, so I'd rather allow people... I like to let people jump in. Otherwise, I have to permit them when they want to talk. So...
Sorry.
So one of the problems you said firstly, it's very hurtful in some ways, where you think, oh, you'd only set a convert up with a convert. And also it doesn't enable integration into the community. What people who've grown up, you know, call it the term FFB, and this is true, by the way, a little bit for Bali Chuva as well. If you grow up from childhood in a setting, there are things that you just know because you absorb it through the environment. No matter how many Mishra Bruachum or somebody picks up, at the end of the day, the way you run a kosher kitchen and the way you run a Shabbos table is having grown up seen it done. Or you don't think about those questions. So for someone who is, in effect, an immigrant to the community, it's very difficult, and you have to be sensitive to that. So the idea of setting up people who did not grow up in the community with one another, really, you know, unless that's what they want, is really, aside from that, maybe hurtful, it makes it much harder for them to integrate into the community. So I want to talk in a moment about Lo Tinasu Giarta, but I want to go to the third one first. V'ika da'amri aramis mamish. No, it means that you shouldn't lie down, or you shouldn't sit down, teishu, on a non-Jew's bed. So why? What's the deal? Like, I know we have kashrus for food. We have kashrus for all sorts of things. Now, this bed is not a kosher bed. What's the story? So the Gemara says the following. U'mishamaisa the Rapapa. Because a story with Rapapa. The Rapapa azal legabe aramis. Rapapa went to an aramis, the non-Jewish woman. The question is why? We'll see in a second I'm going to quote you, Rishonim. It's not in Rashi and Tosfos here, but I'll explain in a second. He went to visit this non-Jewish woman. Hotzia lomita. She brought him out of bed to sit on. Amra lo shev. She said, have a seat. Amar lo, he said to her, Eini yoshev ad shetagbihi esamita. Until you pick up the bed, I want you to pick up the cushions. Higbiya esamita. She lifted up the cushions. Umatsu sham tinok meis. There was a dead child there. Which apparently she was trying to get Rapapa to sit on this bed. And then would accuse him of having killed the child. So what exactly is going on here? When you first read this Gemara, in fact, if you look at Rashi here, Rashi says, Masid Rapapa, Sha'amra lo shave alamita, vahibna mace mutal aleha, vahisa rotse lahalil alav, velomar sheyashav alav aharago. Now you can make a mistake if you're not sufficiently well versed in Jewish history. I'm not so versed in Jewish history, but when I'm learning a Gemara like this, I just scream into the next room and I say, Habiba, can you tell me the following? Because my wife is a medieval Jewish historian. When is the first time that the blood libel came into existence? Now, Rashi sounds like he's describing something like, it's not a blood libel in the blood, but, you know, a Jew being accused of killing non-Jewish children. So the truth is it doesn't actually work because the blood libel didn't exist in Rashi's time. The first blood libel, I think, is around 1170 in Norwich. And that's the first time it's raised. So that really can't be what this is. And if you read Rashi, all Rashi says is she wanted to accuse him. He doesn't say why. Now, there is a passage here in Rabbeinu Nissim, Gon. I don't know if all of you have it on the side. It's printed on the sides of many Gemaras. Rabbeinu Nissim, Gon. So I'm just going to read to you and translate what he says here. He says, Amre, derapapa hoysalo milva eitzel goy. So Rapapa had money that this non-Jewish woman, really, he calls it a goy, not a goy, a man, but a non-Jew owed Rapapa money. And kevan shidachako Rapapa legoy b'milvashalo, when Rapapa was pressing him to pay it back, rotza hagoy lasos alila b'mirma, the goy wanted to play a trick on Rapapa, make an accusation, kidei liyunatzo b'min hatviya shalo. He wanted to get Rapapa off his back. So basically he wanted blackmail to cancel the loan. Ma'asa. Natal tinok echad katan meis. he took a dead child, v'hishkivo al mito shelo, and he put the child on his bed. V'kiso b'begodim, he covered the dead child up with clothing, kidei shelo yargish bo adam, so that no one would, you wouldn't realize it. V'amar lo Rav Papa, bo imi leveisi, v'ani nosein lecha eshe yeshloch etzli. He said to Rav Papa kept nurturing him. He said, okay, come to my house, I'll pay you. Say, halach etzlo, v'nichnas lebeiso. So Rav Papa comes to his house. He enters, amar lo hagoy, shev lecha lamita, have a seat. Nasan ena Rav Papa dvarim, shahayu alamita kodam sheyashav alah. Rav Papa looked carefully at the bed before he sat on it. And then, umatza hatinok meis, he found the dead child, mutman besoch habegodim, hidden inside the clothing. The hirgish hadvarim sheratza les ola lav alilos bereshan. He sensed what the false accusations he wanted to make. Umeosa shah, asru chachamim leishev amita saramis mipneichen. Okay, and that's why the chachamim prohibited it. And he says, v'zeha maisa, this is one of those really interesting stories. There are a couple of famous ones in Shas. Probably the most famous story in Shas is the story with Bruria, and Bruria ended up killing herself. We actually learned this, I think, Rashi and Avodah Zarah and Daf Yud Ches. We don't know where the story comes from. Like, Rashi quotes this long story. We don't know what the source is. So here, Rabbeinu Nissim Gon, who I don't know who this is exactly. I'm not sure when he lived. So he says that Zeh Maisa b'Kabbalahu Etzli, I have this story as a tradition, May Rabbi from my teacher Adonenu Harav HaKadosh Rabbeinu Chushiel Reish Be Rabbanan Zal. I assume that is Rabbeinu Hananel's father. I believe Rabbeinu Hananel's Hananel ben Chushiel. So I'm guessing that's his father. So you're talking about the very late Gaonic period. And then he says, B'gamat Sasioso B'tshuvas HaGaonic Kamochet. So there's a Gaonic tradition on the story, the background to the story of Rav Papa. Why did someone ask him to sit on the bed? What's particularly interesting, though, about the story, so Rashi and Tosos don't say anything here. But if you look in the Mesoras HaShas on our Gemara, you will see that there's a Gemara, so the same Gemara is quoted in Psachim Daf Kuf Yud Beis Amud Beis. And what is so interesting about the citation there, not in the Gemara, but is what Rashi and Tosos both say, Rashbam, and I'm going to read you what Rashbam says there. The Gemara is the same. The Gemara says you're not allowed to sit on a mitas aramis. And the Gemara says, Mishum maisid Rav Papa. Because of the story of Rav Papa, but the Gemara there doesn't tell the story. The Gemara in Psachim just says, maisid Rav Papa. Here, the Gemara tells the story. Now, Rashbam writes there, Rashbam writes, Shahaisa aramis achas chayeves lo ma'os, a non-Jewish woman owed him money, v'nichnas bebeisa legabos heimena, that he entered her house to collect. Chanka esbina, she choked her son. So here she's actually, the story describes, she murders her own son. Unisanatu al hamita, and she put the child on the bed. Uchshenichnas Rav Papa, Amra lo shev al hamita, he told Rav Papa, sit on the bed, ad she'avi ma'osecha, until I bring you money. V'chein asa, and so he did. Kishabasa, when she came back, amra lo, hey matas bini, you killed my son. U'barach lo meha medina. And Rav Papa ran away. Rav Papa ran away. So the story is a little bit different than we have in Brachos.
She kills her son not to
pay. And the question is, what do you do with our Gemara? How do you explain the difference? I'm willing to see if anybody here is willing to take a stab, but I think I know what the answer is. It might be unsettling to some people. Any thoughts? There are only two possibilities, actually. One, which was what I first thought, but on further consideration, I think it's the other. The first thing I thought is that Rashbam and Rashi also, I don't know what the Rashi is in Arvei Psachim, Rashbam had a different version in our Gemara, right? In other words, in our Gemara, Rav Papa says, first pick up the stuff on the bed, and he catches it. And so Rashbam just had a different girsa, a different version in the Gemara. There is another possibility, which I strongly, strongly suspect is correct, although I confess I haven't checked the manuscripts. And that is, this story was not in the Gemara. You see, if you read Rashbam in Arvei Psachim, does not say ki de'isa bebrachos. In other words, the Gemara in Pesachim does not have the story told. It just says Masa de Rav Papa. Rashbam quotes a story, but he doesn't say ki de'isa bebrachos, as is found in Brachos. Now, if it were in the Gemara in Brachos, he probably would have referenced you to tell you how he knew it. Secondly, when you read Rav Nissim Gaon, so it doesn't sound like, it sounds like he's explaining the words Masa de Rav Papa. If you have the Gemara the way we do it, all Rav Nissim Gaon is adding is, he's just adding a detail to the story. Why did Rav Papa go visit this woman? But he's not really adding anything to the Gemara that's necessary. So I strongly, strongly suspect that that from the words the Rav Papa until Mikan Amru Chachamim, Leisha Mitas Aramis is actually not original to the Gemara. And I confess I did not check the manuscript, but I would not be surprised if some of them are missing those particular lines. I think it appears from the Rishonim. Number one, from the fact Rashbam doesn't cite the Gemara and Rav Nissim Gaon seems to be explaining something that's not there. And number two, the fact that Rashbam and Nissim Gaon quote two different versions of the story makes me strongly suspect it's not actually in the Gemara. Okay. Anyway, so that was point number two that Rava told his children. One was, don't cut meat on your hand. Number two is, don't sit on a mitas haramis.
Hey, now, Rabbi?
Yes.
So if it's not in the Gemara, how is it now in the Gemara? Like, who's fiddling with this?
So you have to consider a couple of things. You and I have grown up in a world in which we assume that the Vilna Shas and the Tzura Sadaf, the image of the page, was given at Sinai.
Yeah.
You will not find any Gemara printed today that I've ever seen, printed in the last 30 or 40 years, that doesn't, I don't know if the Taimanim print their own Gemaras and do it differently. You will not find the Gemara that doesn't look like, you know, photo offset of the Alman Aram's, you know, Vilna Shas. You're not going to find it. But once upon a time, the text of the Gemara was a little bit more fluid. Rishonim, when they had problems with Gersa and the Gemara, depending on the proclivities, had a tendency to amend. There is a very important passage in the Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam wrote a book called the Sefer HaYashar. There are two parts to it. There's some one part called the Chidushim, which is very much like the material we find quoted Rabbeinu Tam in Tosus and Shas. And then he wrote the Shelos U'Tshuvos, both called the Sefer HaYashar. In the introduction to one of them, I don't remember which one, Rabbeinu Tam writes, he says, you know, he speaks about a cherem against Magihei Sfarim, against those who amend the text. And we don't know that there was ever an official convocation that somebody put a cherem on it, but Rashbam says, as much as my grandfather Rashi amended the text, my brother Rashbam did 10 times as much. And Rabbeinu Tam hated that. Rabbeinu Tam was totally opposed to solving problems by amending the text. You'll note, whenever Rashi says, Hachi Garsinan, it's essentially a giveaway that he amended the text. Maybe he had another manuscript that's possible, but typically not. So there was, even in the early period of the Rishonim, there are emendations of text when they think the text is corrupted. Once you go back a little early into the Gaonic period, we don't really know when the Gemara was written down. And when you have an oral text, it's very easy for interpretation cited along to get incorporated. But I'm going to go a step further for you, Lenny. A more interesting phenomenon. There are a number of mesechtas in Shas, one particularly Bava Metzia, which the Ritva at the beginning of Bava Metzia points out, and the Ramban also says. Ritva says that there's a lot of material in this mesechta from the Baal Halachas Gedolos. It means interpolations into the text. The Baal Halachas Gedolos, we don't know exactly who it is, but he's one of the Gaonim. He's one of the Gaonim. You have Rav Yudai Gaon or Rav Shimon Kayar, I think. You're talking about probably a 9th century Gaon, I think. So the question is, how does all this material of the Bahag wind up in the Gemara? So the answer is actually fairly easy. The first thing is that the Bahag's language, his dialect, was Babylonian Aramaic, meaning he writes in the same language that the Gemara is written in. The second step is the following. What we know from some manuscripts is that what some of the Gaonim would do is they would copy the Gemara, and then they would write the word Peirush, or in the middle of the Gemara, Peyud, and abbreviate it, and then they would introduce their commentary. And then they would resume writing the text of the Gemara. We have something very similar to that in the Qumran scrolls, the Pisharim, like Pesher Chavakuk and Pesher Nachum at Qumran. The way they would do it is they would write the biblical text, they would write a pasuk, write two pasukim, write a phrase, and then they would say, U Pishro, And its interpretation is they would give their interpretation of whatever they meant. They have a little blank and they'd start the next pasuk. What happens sometimes in the manuscripts that had this is the word perush fell out. And because the Baal Halachos Gedolos is writing in Babylonian Aramaic, you can no longer tell what is the Gemara and what is the commentary. I can show you examples, not now, where we can see this, where you can see that we show them don't have a particular thing we have in our Gemara, and some in the manuscripts have the comment of our Gemara with the word perush that precedes it. So it can happen very easily, either in the text or maybe even from the margins. If someone wrote a commentary on the side and the next scribe thought, oh, it was not a commentary, it was an omission from the text, he might in his copy now copy that in. So there are many ways for these things to happen if you sort of study the history of text. So I don't know specifically this one. I'd like to believe that on the whole, it was not intentional, but you can never really be sure. We would regard someone adding in something into the text of the Gemara as sacrilegious. Clearly for the Rishonim, amending the text because they thought it was difficult, they thought it was missing something, was not quite the same sacrilege that we would regard it as. But then again, they were Rishonim living 1,000 years ago and we're not. So that perhaps is to be, is understandable.
Is it possible that it was inserted because to have read the prohibition about a bed of a non-Jew from the non-Jewish censors would have been totally regarded as anti-non-Jew, and this creates a reason for that prohibition?
So I don't know. You have for that, again, I didn't check the manuscripts to see. If it's in any of the early manuscripts, then you can't explain it that way. In other words, censorship only becomes an issue probably close to a century after the printing press is established. And as the first Shas in Venice, the full Shas in the 1520s is uncensored. Right? It's only later that censorship of Jewish books begins after censorship of Christian books. So that it's possible. But also the Gemara does say, Mishum Maisa D'Rapapa, number one. And number two, this is not the kind of story I think a Christian would want to see put in the Gemara. Now, I pointed out before the anachronism. If I didn't have a resident Jewish historian, I would have walked into our shir and said, ah, you see how early the blood libel, you see that Rashi is filling in his blood libel context into the Gemara, even though clearly the blood libel didn't exist at the time of the Gemara. But as it turns out, there's no blood libel in the time of Rashi either. So you have to, in terms of the censorship issue, that's a 16th century issue. So if any of the manuscripts have it, so then it's not going to, that won't be able to explain it, I think. I think the more likely explanation is, again, I know this would be the third case in Shas. The other two, the Gemara doesn't tell the story. But it'd be the third case where the Gemara refers to Maisa or something like that, and it doesn't tell us the story. So you're dying to know, what was the story? Right? How could the text leave out the juiciest part? And the answer, so the Rishonim fill it in, but somebody decided accidentally, or maybe and somebody decided on purpose, maybe even, let's just put the story in so we'll understand. Okay.
Can I ask a question about the Hagos Hagra?
Yes.
Who was one of the biggest Magihim. Mm-hmm. He didn't amend the text. Am I right? I mean, he just... He wrote on the side what he thought the text was supposed to be.
So I'm not familiar with how the Gra actually wrote because I only see the published version. What I will tell you about the Hagos HaGra is they're actually different in nature for the most part than the Hagos of Rashi. There are many ways the Hagos HaGra are problematic, but the Gra almost never amends texts on the basis of his svara. He amends it on the basis of another text. I mean, it could be a manuscript, but very often, like when you read, look at the Hagos HaGra and the Tosefta. I don't like it at all as an academic, my academic side, because basically when the Talmud Bavli quotes the Tosefta in a certain way, the Gra ends up leveling the Tosefta to match that which the Bavli has. I would argue it's methodologically unsound, because you have to treat it, it's not my argument, many before me have argued, you have to treat it as two different texts.
Thank you.
Because the Gra is not amending it because he thinks the text should read this way. He's a mandate usually based upon another text. I don't know how he wrote them. In other words, I don't know. I think generally when Haggadahs were written in the more recent period, they don't write it in the text, but they put it on in the margins, right? Haggadahs Habach, which are earlier than the Gra, right? They're not inserted into the text. They're put on the side. Interestingly enough, there's a famous tshuva on the Sefer HaYashar. Rabbeinu Tam had one particular person he did not get along with very well, Rabbeinu Meshulam of Meilun. He lived in Provence, and there are a number of famous places in Shas where Rabbeinu Tam, where the Tosfos quotes Rabbeinu Tam disagreeing with Rabbeinu Meshulam. And so Rabbeinu Tam wrote a very sharp letter, and he preserved it in his Tshuvas to Rabbeinu Meshulam, and accusing him of amending text. And Rabbeinu Meshulam responds, he's got a lot of tongue-in-cheek in this Tshuva, where he basically says, Rabbeinu, what you do is much worse, because you guys amend text. He says, your grandfather and your brother, they amended text, and they didn't even tell anyone. And I don't even complain about them. But when I want to suggest an emendation of the text, I talk about both the text that was and what I think the text that should be, meaning I preserve both. So in the modern versions, that's standard. Nobody, for the most part, emends the text itself. They put notes in the margin saying, Sarach Lomar, it should be this, it should be that. But I think that the Hagos of the Gras, I said before, are fundamentally of a different nature. They're not Hagos because the text is difficult per se, but because the Gra is levenly based upon another text or what other Gersos that the Rishonim had, not that the Gra is creating an emendation, as we would say, Misvara Denafshe, his own idea why he thinks the text should be different. I'm not saying he never does that, but my familiarity with Hagos Hagra, they're almost all in that category.
Okay. I don't want to take Shear's time with a follow-up question, but maybe after the Shear's over, I could ask you a question. What do you think about the Hagos Hagra?
Okay. Fine. Okay. So now the Gemara has to get to the third one. So one more thing. So I wanted to talk about Lotinas for Giyorta. What is the business about not marrying Giyoras? So the Rishonim don't comment here at all, but I believe, I forget where I saw this, I don't know if this is in Psachim, it might be there, where one of the Rishonim says, because of a concern of Onas Hager. What I take it to mean is that a person, inevitably, spouses hurt one another's feelings. That's part of being human, that's part of life. So certainly hurting someone's feeling is a serious Avera, it's Onas Dvarim. But it's even a bigger Avera when it comes to Onas Hager, because on top of Onas Devarim, of causing emotional pain, which applies to any other person, on top of that, the Torah many times warns about a ger. There is a very, and in this light, it's very interesting. There is a Gemara that seems very, again, it would be very off-putting to someone who's a convert, and there are multiple interpretations. I think you'll appreciate this particular machlokas. The Gemara says in Yevamos, that when a prospective convert comes, we try to discourage them. Now, why do we discourage them from converting? So one of the issues, the Gemara says, a very harsh statement. It says, Koshim Gerim li Yisrael kisapachas, that Gerim are hard for the Jewish people like a sapachas, like a negat saras, as a sapachas. So what does that mean? It sounds terrible. So there are kind of two opposite poles in Tosos. One interpretation is because Gerim don't know enough, Jews, you know, born Jews end up learning from their behaviors and end up not observing Torah properly. That's one way of seeing it. However, Tosus quotes Rabbeinu Avraham Hager, who says, no, the reason why Kashim Geirim LeYisrael Kisapachas is because Geirim who come and convert are so frum, they observe mitzvahs with such punctiliousness, is that they make the rest of the Jewish people look bad. And he refers to a Gemara, a Pasuk actually, when Eliyahu comes to the Tzarfatit, and her son dies, and Malachim Aleph, I think Perek Yud Zayin, and her son dies, and she says to Eliyahu, Basa Eli Lahaskir Savoni, you've come to me in order to remind of my sin. What is Eliyahu doing? So the Chazal say, what she was arguing is that before you came here, I was a tzaddekus compared to everybody else who lived in this town, and that was a schus for me. Now you come, and compared to you, I'm a Rasha, and now God punished me. So the same thing, Kashim Gael Yisrael Sapachas, because they're so medaktik in mitzos that therefore they basically make born Jews look bad. So you may have some of that, again, that same tension in this particular statement. Okay.
Rabbi, I have a question since you touched about Geirus.
Yes.
You can tell me if you want to answer it now or later. Avraham.
How about not at all? Yes.
Okay, goodbye. End the question.
No, go ahead.
The origin of our religion was a proselytizing religion. Avram sat in the tent. People ate. They said, thank you. He said, thank Hashem. And he taught them about Yahdut. We had the Erev Rav who came from Egypt. So there was many, it was easy to come and join us. When did the Jewish religion turn into, no, it's hard. Don't, you don't want to do this. Don't convert. We don't want you, or it's not for you. It's hard.
If I were to give you the honest historical answer, probably in the rabbinic period. That is the most likely answer. We do know, by the way, one other data point as well, which is the phobomenoi of Josephus. Josephus speaks of all these God-fearers who were kind of, they seem like they were semi-Jewish, but I think that maybe this is, I don't know if this is still accepted, but the primary obstacle, pagans found Judaism very appealing in the Greco-Roman period. Because if you think about it, firstly, you've got a Shabbos. That was unique at that point to Jews. In fact, the pagans considered Jews lazy because we didn't work on Shabbos. But if you think the idea of having one day a week off is tremendous. Now we just take it for granted, the whole world has it. But that was the Torah's, one of the Torah's major visible contributions to humanity, Ad Hayom Hazeh. So Judaism and the food restrictions weren't such a big deal. I mean, your day wasn't once as crazy as it is now. So the only, there was really probably one primary obstacle, which as I like to say, is the reason why the world is is Christian and not Jewish. And that is Bris Mila. Which was very much not a pagan thing. And for those of you who've seen the movie, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and that famous scene with Mel Brooks, you know, the rabbi, and circumcision, you'll understand why the world is Christian and not Jewish, because Bris Mila was a major obstacle. So I think that until that period, at the same time, what I will point out to you is firstly, Avraham might have been proselytizing, but you'll notice none of his firstly, it's in the Medrash. It's in the Medrash more than in the text. And you'll notice that the Jewish people did not descend from any of those people. Also notice that Chazal's reading of the Erev Rav is that Moshe didn't ask God, and they were the ones who caused the Egel. So you can argue that that's a rereading. I mean, the first one is Midrashic. The Targum says, that's Midrashic. That's not Pshat. The Erev Rav, you could make an argument there, but it's clear that it may be that in the rabbinic period that you know is when you have a shift. It, to the extent that if we can be sure, and it's not 100%, but if we can assume that once we were more open to it, certainly Chazal already marked the transition period.
And we could go back to Naomi. Naomi did that with Ruth. The discouragement, you know.
Correct. Well, Chazal learned from there, but the cat, in other words, you can't, you know, the plural of anecdote is not data, right? So for the Medrash, it certainly is, but you know, that Naomi would have discouraged Rus from coming back with her, you know, listen, the fact is that integrating into a community is hard. It's very, very hard. And when a ger comes, forget the halachic requirement, it's important that a prospective ger gerus understand that it may not be easy to integrate, right? It can be very difficult, especially for them. And it doesn't make it easier for their children. So it's hard to know whether to read, you know, Naomi Lepshat as a broader halachic principle, which Chazal do, right? She pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally, so I don't know if you can necessarily prove from that. Okay. All right, so now number three. The third one is Al Tabar Achore Beis Akneses Bishah Shatzibur Mispalam, on the fourth wide line in the Gemara. So the Gemara says, Misaye Lein Rabbi Yoshua. This is a proof for Rabbi Yoshua, the Amar, Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Osir Lo La'adam Sheyavar Achore Beis Akneses Bishah Shatzibur Mispalam. So one is not allowed to go behind the Beis Akneses when the Tzibur is davening. One comment on this I thought to be very, very strange. Rava is a fourth generation Babylonian Amora. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi is a first generation Eretz Yisrael Amora. Rava was very prominent, but so was Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Rishonim, I was just looking at this morning, not in our Gemara, somewhere else, comments, I forget who it was who said it, that we always paschal like Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. It's very strange for the Gemara to say, Misayel Rabbi Shua ben Levi from a Amora who lived 150 years later. And I have a suspicion, but none of the manuscripts back me up, that earlier when the Gemara said Amar Lehu Rava Livnei, I think the Gears is wrong. I think it should be Amar Lehu Rebbe Livnei. I don't know why I think that, but I think so. And if it were, that would make sense why it would be Misayel Rabbi Shua ben Levi, who was probably a Talmud of Rebbe, of Rabbi Hudanas. But be it as it may, it's the exact same statement, that you're not allowed to go walk behind the shul when the tzibur is davening. Now, why? So Rashi writes about 12, 13 lines at the bottom of the Rashi's, Osur lavar v'chulei shenira kimavriach atzmo mi pesach beis haknesses shebe mizrach. It's a very difficult line to understand. it makes you look like you're running away from the eastern door. Okay, so you run. What's the big deal? So I think if you look in Arvei Pesachim, where this Gemara is quoted, or in my case, I don't have to actually look there. I can look. I think it's here. Yes, from a Rashi in Erevin. And not most of you don't have this, but on my very nice Oz V'Hadar Shas, on the right side, I have something called Likutei Rashi. And what the printers did here, what somebody did is they collected all the other Rashis from other places in Shas that might be interpreting the very same Gemara, so you can see what Rashi wrote in different places. And there Rashi writes, "Dechevan she'enu nichnas," because you don't enter the shul. This is actually from later brachos. Nire kiporek ol umevaza beisakneses. They're davening. I don't daven. I'm not interested in the shul. And that's what Rashi writes later in brachos. And Erevin, he writes, shenire kikofer kikofer. He feels like a kofer. He's a denier. He's a heretic. Sheomed meacharei aveinu nichnas. Right. They're davening. He doesn't believe in davening. Okay. So that is a little more understandable. Now Abaye comes along. And he makes modifications. Amar Abaye, v'lo amaran, this statement only applies. They only said this. Ela deleka pisa harina. There's no other door to the Beis HaKnesses. Aval ika pisa harina. Leslan ba. If there's another door, then it's not a problem because someone who sees you walk by, this is about appearances. This is not about, you may have a reason. You davened already. You're doing something else, whatever it is. But if there's a second door, someone who sees you pass by the first door is not going to think you're kofar. They think, oh, he's going to go in the other door. He'll be on the other side of the shul. And then Abaye adds, "Aval ika pischa chrina leslamba." It's not a problem. "V'lo amaran el deleka be krishta chrina." It only applies if there's no other shul in town. "Aval ika be krishta chrina leslamba," because someone presumably will say, he's davening in the other shul. You know, as they say, this is the shul, he doesn't daven it. And "V'lo amaran Ella de lo dare tuna, velo rahit, velo manach tfilin." If he's carrying a burden, or he's running, or he's wearing tfilin, in the first two cases, people realize he's busy, right? He's got to get somewhere. That's why he's running. He's carrying a burden. He can't put it down here. Or he's wearing tfilin, meaning obviously he's a firm person. It's not that he doesn't believe in it, but there's some reason he's not coming in. Then it's a problem. If he doesn't have one of those, aval ika chad mehanach, any one of those three, less lenba. In other words, for Abaye, it's clear from Abaye that it's an issue of appearances, and as long as a person doesn't get off the wrong appearance, so it's not a problem for a person who does believe in davening in shul, but for whatever reason, he's not coming into shul at this particular point. Okay, fine. So that is the end of Rava, or my suggestion, but I'm probably wrong, Rebbe's statement of three things that he told his children. Now the Gemara has another, a couple of more ethical wills, and then we're actually back to really brachos, meat and potatoes halacha. Rabbi Lichtstein.
Yeah, why do you have a hunch that it's Rebbe and not Rava?
Because Rabbi Yeshua, to say Messiah le Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi from a statement of Rava, the chronology per se, it's a very strange kind of proof. Normally, you know, Messiah le normally, I don't want to say always comes from a brisa, comes from a Tanaitic source typically. So to say that Rava's statement is Misayele, the Rishu ben Levi, is just odd. Right? In other words, and Rava's statement is also not made, it's not like if Rava were explaining, giving the simple, straightforward explanation of a Mishnah, and now you said, with that explanation, Misayele, Rishu ben Levi, I don't understand. But Rava just telling his children, you know, that the Al-Tabra Achori Beis HaKnesset Shoshim Mitzvot Tfilin, that's Misayele, Rishu ben Levi. If it were Rebbe speaking, so it's a Tana. So I did check the manuscripts. Every one of them has Rava. So I could explain how it happened easily, by the way. In the same way that probably one of the most common scribal errors in Shas is confusion of Rava and Rava. Right? Rava, Abaye's arguing partner, and Rava, Rabbi Yosef's arguing partner. And why is that the most common confusion? Because very frequently scribes, to save ink, to save paper, because they were lazy, they would abbreviate lots of words. And they abbreviated Rava and Rava as resh base and put a little shrich, you know, a little apostrophe. And then you're looking at resh base. Well, is that Rava or is that Rava? You can't tell. It easily could have happened here as well, resh base, and someone unabridged it to Rava, and it should have been unabridged to Rebbe. So, again, I don't have evidence to it. It's just it's a speculation, but there's something that's really bothering me. Okay. So next the Gemara continues. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Akiva, Bishlosha Dvarim, Ohev Anias Hamadim. There are three things in which I love the meats. The people of Madai. Kishe Chotchen Es Habasar, In Chotchen Ela Agave HaShochan. So that you can see is connected to one of Rabbi's three things. Don't cut it on the table. Always cut it on the table. When they kiss someone in greeting them, enoshken ela agavayat, on the back of the hand. So Rashi says, I don't really understand this, but he says, v'derech kashiva suzeh mipnei harok. I don't know if he means you don't want someone's, you know, saliva on the front of your hand, which you're always touching things with, so they kiss on the back of the hand. Okay. And finally, he says that kishayoatzin, in Yoatzin Elabasada, when they choose to have counsel, to consult, private consultations, they only do it in the field, never in a building where there might be someone's eavesdropping. Amar of Ada Barava, my craw, how do you know this? See, because he says, Vayishlach Yaakov, when Yaakov wanted to talk to his wives about wanting to go home because of what Laban had done, it says, Vayishlach Yaakov, Vayikra L'Rachel Ulayah, Hasadeh El Tzono. Right, Yaakov didn't go and talk to them in the house because who knows what kind of eavesdropping devices Laban had planted there. But rather, he went call them to the field to talk to them there where nobody would be able to hear their conversations. Rashi here quotes a very interesting folk proverb, which I believe is from Vayikra Rava. If you look at Rashi, Ela Basada, he says, "The Amre Inshi Osnayim Lakosa," which I think we do use the expression, the walls have ears. So I don't know when the earliest occurrence of this expression is, but it's got to go back at least to the 4th or 5th century. It's here in Rashi, but it's actually in Vayikra Rava. Okay, Osnayim Lakosa, the walls have ears. Okay, so that
was... I think that Yoatzin here doesn't mean give counsel. It means consulting, having a consulting discussion, because that's what Yaakov had with Rachel and Leah.
Well, I would say it has negative connotations, but plotting, if you're trying to implement plans that you don't want to get out, so that's fine. Then the Gemara has one last statement, which is rather interesting in its own right. Tanya, Amar Rabban Gamliel, B'shlosha Dvarim Ohev Anias Aparsim. I love the Persians for three things. I appreciate them for three things. Hein Tznuim Ba'achilasam, they are Tznuim in the way they eat. Utsluim bibeis akise, when they use the bathroom, and this is a point that's going to come up later in the Masechta, that even when a person, again, part of it is their bathrooms were more exposed places, but generally speaking, the idea of having tznius even when you're in private. And then the last one to me is the most interesting, utsluim bidavar acher. They are tznuim in another matter. What is the davar acher? Rashi says tashmish. Now this is actually a very, very interesting statement that the Gemara is quoting. The Gemara doesn't explain what, but I can tell you what. But it's very interesting that Rabban Gamliel liked this. The Gemara in Ksubos in the 4th Perek speaks about something called the Minog Parsium when it came to intercourse, which is they would have it clothed. Now, the Gemara has the following statement in Ksubos. I think it's around Daf Mem Vav Mem Zayin. The Gemara says, Kola Omer, Efshi Ela Ani Bibigdi Vihi Bibigda. A man who says that I do not want to have sex with my wife unless we're both essentially fully clothed, except for the parts that are truly necessary, yotzi v'yitein k'minag parsiyim, and he has to divorce her if she wants a divorce. Meaning it's not an acceptable fulfillment of the mitzvah of she'era, of she'er k'sus fa'ona, because the Gemara has one interpretation that when it says in Mishpatim a husband must provide for his wife she'er k'sus fa'ona, she'era is she'er bisra. It means having contact with the flesh. So the Gemara, that's halacha psuka, that what he praises here, that's what, so it's so surprising. What he praises is tznuim and tashmish, at least what the Gemara in Ksubos describes as minak parsiyim, is grounds for a wife in being entitled to a divorce and receipt of a ksuba. Meaning that is not considered, if both parties are regarded, want it, it's technically acceptable, but at least the way we paskin the halacha, it is one of the requirements of a marriage from both spouses, one to another, of what Chazal terms share basar. Okay. So I'm not quite sure what to do with Rami Gamliel, unless he meant some other aspects of Tashmish that they would snow him in. But that's what Rabban Gamliel said. Okay. So now, now we return to our regularly scheduled programming. It took a very long time, but we have arrived back. The Gemara here is going to quote two brises. One is found in the Tosef and the Yerushalmi, and the other one is not. The two statements are similar but different, and we'll see what in a second. Amar Rabbi, firstly, Rabban Gamliel Omer. So let's remind ourselves what it said in the Mishnah. Rabban Gamliel said that the Zman Kriya Shema of the night goes all the way until Amud HaShachar. The Chachamim said until Chatzos. Rabban Gamliel said Ad Alos HaShachar. So Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Halacha Ki Rabban Gamliel. We paskin like Rabban Gamliel? Fine. Obviously, l'chatchila, one is supposed to come home in the evening, and you learn a little. You learn a little chumash, you learn a little mishnah, you then say kriya shma, and you daven, and then you can go home and eat. That was the Gemara had on Daf Gimel Amud Beis, the way a person is supposed to behave. You should read kriya shma as soon as possible. But if you didn't, so you can read kriya shma all night. So now the Gemara quotes the Braisa. Tanya. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer, Pa'amim she'adam kore kriya shma, shtei pa'amim balayla. Sometimes a person can read, in theory, kriya shma.
Rabbi, yes? You didn't do the last part. There were a couple of anishivetu mitashi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did skip that. Yes, and I wanted to talk about that also. Okay, let's go back. Put that on pause a second. After Rabbi Gamliel just praised the Persians, Anit Sivesi Lim Kudashai. The Pasuk in Yeshaya, the Pshat speaks about God calling his designated ones to inflict destruction upon Bavel. That's what the chapter's talking about in Yeshaya. Now, why are they called Mikudashai? So Tani Rabbi Yosef, Elu Aparsim, these are the Persians. Hamikudashim, who are designated umuzumanim ligehenim. So that's kind of interesting. You think about it, two things. Firstly, Rabban Gamliel has just spoken in praise of the Persians, number one. And number two, the Pasuk in Yeshaya is speaking about God's anointed ones, chosen ones, who are to destroy Bavel. So Rabbi Yosef takes that Pasuk and uses it to describe the Persians. So what's going on here? So I think the answer is actually very simple. There are, I have to remember the names because it shouldn't be my field. I think there is Sasanian Persia, I think is the later Persian period. I forget what the earlier one is called. Around the early Amoraic period, so the Zoroastrians took over and they basically, overthrew the previous government, and they were a far less tolerant group. Much less tolerant than the previous people. The Gemara sometimes refers to them as the Chabarim. And they say that the Asu Chabari LeBavel. When they came to Bavel, things changed. And the Amoraim, some of them, we might have learned this in Avodah Zarah, some preferred the Romans and some preferred the Persians. But clearly, Rabban Gamliel is talking about the earlier Persian period, where they were much more tolerant in general, and things were very good. And Rav Yosef comes along, and those Persians were the ones who destroyed Bavel, is the way the term is, the previous kingdom. And Rav Yosef comes along and says, those people are the ones on the Kudashim Legehenim. Right? He's talking about different Persians than Rabban Gamliel is talking about. Okay. Rabbi Friedman, I'm Yotze. Sorry about that. Okay. So now, let's come back to where we were, the Braisa. Tanya. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer, Pa'amim she'adam korei kriya shma shtei pa'amim balayla. Achas kodem she'alam rashachar, v'achas li'achar she'alam rashachar. So a person, the way Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai describes this, is a person reads kriya shma twice at night. Once before dawn, and once after dawn. I will add in one detail, certainly before sunrise. And your Yotze both Kriya Shmas with it. That's what he says. So the Gemara now asks a very basic question. Hagufa Kasha. There's an internal contradiction in what Rav Shimon ben Yochai just said. He said, Amris pa'amim sh'adam kari kriya shema shtei pa'amim ba'layla. You said that sometimes a person reads two kriya shema two times at night. Alma, from this you see, that la'achar sh'yala min ha'shachar, that after dawn, as long as let's say it's before sunrise, lel yahu, it's night. V'hadar tani, but then you turn around and say, yotze v'hen yudei chavaso, achas shayom v'achas shalayla. That you can be yotze after alos ha'shachar, even though it's, you just said it's layla, you can be yotze kriya shema of the day, alma, yamamahu. You see, that is considered day. So, which is it? Is it night or is it day? If you can be yotze kriya shema of the day after dawn, so then why not call it day? If it's actually night, why can you be yotze the kriya shema of the day? So the Gemara answers the following. Lo, it really, it's not day. La'olam lel yahu. It really is night. But v'ha dekari le'yom is the ika inshe dekaime ve'ahi shaita. The reason why it's called day is because there are some people who are already getting up at that time. So again, how does that solve the problem though? So Rashi explains. Rashi says, Lel Yahu ad hanetzachama, four lines from the bottom of the page on Rashi. But the, so the answer, the kaimi bayishaita, hilkach, tzman kriyashma de yomhu, de gabe kriyashma uve kumecha ksiv, v'ha kaimi. So Rashi says, what the, you have to understand the following. And we spoke about this a while back when we started the Masechta. The Mishnah in Megillah in the second parak speaks about kol shemitzvaso bayom k'shera kol hayom, kol shemitzvaso balayla k'shera kol halayla. Mitzvahs that have to be done during the day are good all day. Mitzvahs that have, like Mikra Megillah, mitzvahs that have to be done at night can be done all night, right? So let's say Ksiras Omer or something like that. So normally mitzvahs are mitzvahs of the day or mitzvahs of the night. But Kriya Shema is different. Kriya Shema is not defined by day and night. It's not that the halachic requirement of Kriya Shema Shashachis is by yom, and the halachic requirement of Kriya Shema Shel Arvis is at night, but rather it's Bishoch Becha Uvekumecha. And it is possible, and not only possible, it is the reality, and it's certainly true for us, but it was even true at the time of the Gemara, that Shchiva and Kima, Bishoch Becha Uvekumecha, do not align exactly with yom and laila. In other words, obviously, there is a fair amount of overlap, but nonetheless, it may not be complete. So Rashi says here that Lagabe mitzvos in general, if you want to know, is it yom, is it laila? The answer is, it's laila still, after dawn, until maybe sunrise. But with respect to Kriya Shema, it's already considered uvekumecha, because since some people are getting up at that time, that's the zman of Kriya Shema Shel Yom. That's how Rashi understood it. So I want to start Tosfos at least. I don't know that we're going to, we might finish this Tosfos, but let's see, because there are actually a couple of other approaches to this. So Tosfos, the bottom Tosfos on Daf Ches Amud Beis says, Lo la'olam lel yahu, tema. Tosfos asks the following question. You may have a hard time understanding it at first, what his question is. Lema Ravusa, why does the Braisa, why does Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai tell us the Chiddush that you could say Kriya Shema once before dawn, once after dawn, and be Yotze both Kriya Shemas? Tema, if in fact, after dawn, as the Gemara says, really is Lelya, then Lema Ravusa, Imke Lema Ravusa, say a bigger Chiddush. She pa'amim yesh adam kore la'achar she'alam na'shachar shnei pa'amim. Wait, now Tosfos didn't understand exactly like Rashi did. Tosfos understood when the Gemara said Lel Yahu is that fundamentally it's still night. And really, mitzvahs that you do at night, you can do at that time. And that includes Kriya Shema Shel Arvis. Ah, but why can someone be Yotze Kriya Shema Shel Shachris also at that time? The answer is because some people are getting up. So Tosfos doesn't say, he doesn't formulate this way, but it's like, it's both Zman Shchiva and Zman Kima. So you remember, Rashi said already, and Tosfos is going to come to that answer, I believe. Rashi said already that no, that when we say, La'olam Lel Yahu, it means by mitzvos halayla, But Kriya Shema is not determined by Laila and Yom. It's determined by Shchiva and Kima. And after dawn, Rashi says, is not Shchiva. You can't do Zman Kriya Shema Shel Arbis anymore. You can only do a Kriya Shema Shel Shachos. But Tosus didn't understand that. Anyway, Tosus understood, La'olam basically it's Laila for all purposes. But if you wanted to read Kriya Shema Shel Shachos, you could, because there are some people getting up then. And most people aren't. So it's kind of, it's Zman Shchiva, but it's also a little bit Zman Kima. So Tosus says, no, I got that wrong. V'yesh lomar. Mitzvahs that are genuinely mitzvahs hayom, like tefillin and tzitzis. So those, it's night for. You can't put them on after night, after dawn. Aval gabe kriya shma lo, hovavik insha dekaima bishaita lav zman shchivo. Kriya shma shel arvis, you can't read after dawn, because that's already called Zman Kima. In other words, it's either Zman Shchiva or it's Zman Kima. And this opinion, this Braisa holds that it is actually Zman Kima. Okay. Now, Tosos adds one last note here, which is the last thing I want to read for today. But then, as we're going to see next week, Tosos actually didn't finish this Tosos. The next Tosos really should be part of one with this Tosos. We'll see why next week. But Tosa says the following, there's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, sounds as if you can read Kriya Shema Shel Shachris right after Andon. And it's not true. The Mishnah on the next daf, Tesam Adays, is going to talk about Zman Kriya Shema Shel Shachris. And nobody there says that you can say Zman Kriya Shema Shel Shachris after dawn. It has to be at least a bit after dawn. Ad Sheyakir, until you can tell the difference between the Tcheles and the Lavan in something. The two different colors in some place where you need a certain amount of light to be able to tell the difference. Okay. So this is the way Tosos approached the problem. The way to explain why you can't read Kriya Shema both times, but after Amura Shachar, is the way effectively Rashi said in the first place, is that when the Gemara answered La'olam Lel Yehu, it means Lagabe Mitzvos HaLaila. But Kriyashna is not a mitzvah dictated by Laila. Kriyashma is a mitzvah dictated by Zman Shchiva, and after dawn is no longer Zman Shchiva, it's Zman Kima. So even though for all other mitzvahs it's Laila, for Kriyashma it's like it's day. Now, there is one problem. There is one significant problem with this particular approach, which I'm not going to answer now, but I'm going to point it out to you, is as presented here, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is absolutely against the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah in Megillah that I referenced before, that kol davar shemitzvah sabayom, mitzvah sabayom, kol hayom, the Mishnah says, l'chatchila, you're supposed to do it after nates, but as long as you did it after Amar HaShachar Yoyotze. So for example, Bris Milah may not be done at night. Well, that's a bad example. Once you do the Bris Milah, it might be done. But let's say, maybe. Let's say Lulav and Esrog, the Arba Minim. The Arba Minim, you're supposed to pick up after sunrise. But let's say you're going on a business trip, you have to get out long before sunrise. So if you need to and you pick up the Arba Minim, the Lulav and Esrog, and others after dawn, then you're Yotze. But L'chatchila, it's supposed to be done after Netzach Hama. So the question is going to be, how can the Gemara here say, at least, maybe Rabbi Shimon Yochai disagrees, how can you say that after Neitz Hachama, after dawn, is considered night? Me'ikar Hadin and B'di'eved, post facto, it's certainly day. So that's one of the questions we have to deal with. But we're going to see that going back to the first question of Tosos, Tosos assumed, the Havamina, the question of Tosos assumed that you could do both Kriya Shmas after dawn and be Yotze night and day. And his answer was no. You can only, but right now you can only be Yotze the day one, but we're going to see that there are actually two other opinions in Rishonim, including one at the end of the next Tosfos, which we are going to deal with. Any questions on what we've done?
I have a question about the Vilna Gaon.
Okay, so I'm gonna stop the recording. Okay. And then